Hello, I'm Jeff Mervis, Deputy News Editor of Science Magazine. We're going to be talking today about science in the next Congress. And I'm joined today by five retiring legislators who have thought about these issues for many years and have played a major role in setting some of these policies. Let me introduce each one of them, and then we'll get started. Joining us is Alan Mollahan, Democrat from West Virginia, Chairman of the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Commerce, Justice, and Science. He was defeated in a Democratic primary and is leaving after 28 years in the House. Brian Baird, a clinical psychologist and a Democrat from Washington State. He's chair of the Science Committee's Energy and Environment Panel, and he's retiring after 12 years in the House. Bob Inglis, Republican from South Carolina. He's the former chair of the Science Committee's Research Panel, and he was defeated in the Republican primary and is leaving after serving 2 6-year stints in the House. And finally, Sherry Bollert, Republican from New York. He chaired the Science Committee from 2001 to 2007 when he retired after 24 years in the House. Welcome, gentlemen. Thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Excellent. Okay, let me start with the question which I think is on a lot of scientists' minds after the election, which is, are the recommendations in the Rising Above the Gathering Storm report, known colloquially as RAGS, still alive, or are they dead under this new political climate? And to put it another way, can you pursue an innovation agenda without additional spending? Anybody want to start us off?
I'll take it. This is Congressman Brian Baird. I chair the Energy and Environment Subcommittee, and Bob's the ranking member on that. We passed the America Competes Act, which was drawn directly from Rising Above the Gathering Storm. Of course, we had previously passed it. We passed a reauthorization of that with substantial continued funding for ARPA-E and for the various other science education and research support measures. It did not pass in the Senate. There are two challenges. If we have a continuing resolution instead of some form of omnibus appropriation, some of that funding, notably ARPA-E and others, may well go to zero, which I think would be a tragedy for the country because these are some of the most exciting and constructive measures Congress has passed to keep our country competitive. The challenge will be in the future when people are talking about across-the-board cuts and budget levels down to 2008 levels. That would be a fairly significant, to say the least, cut across the board in science. And if they in some way were to say we're going to roll back not only the budgetary levels, but back the programs that existed then, it would eliminate a number of the innovations from America Competes, and I think set the country back. So the real question is going to be, how do we achieve those budget cuts without harming the kinds of investments that are going to be necessary to get the country out of the fiscal constraint we're in the long term?
Okay. Mr. Inglis, how do you think the new members, the Republican members of the House who are going to be coming, feel about those issues that Mr. Baird just raised? And do they think they're important? Do they think that Competes needs to be reauthorized, that those agencies need to be funded at adequate levels?
Well, I think it's going to be a difficult period of adjustment for folks in the scientific community to figure out funding streams and whether they're going to be continuing. And as a Republican who thinks they should, let me first just thank the scientific community and the readers of Science Magazine for hanging in there through this process, because it is, I would think, a very disconcerting time for people that are doing important work and that see real opportunities ahead in terms of breakthroughs and then wonder about the funding stream. So it's hard for me to guess exactly what the path of that of the new Congress will be, but my hope is that after a period of adjustment, we all come to realize that this really is not a Republican or Democrat issue. This is an issue of American competitiveness, and this is an opportunity for us. You know, I was just in Taiwan, and it's very interesting to me that their equivalent of our NSF is spending about the dollars that we spend. We spend money elsewhere in DOE and DOD, but a country of 26 million people, as opposed to our country of 300 million, their level of commitment to science really is pretty impressive, and it makes ours look suspect. And so if we're really going to compete in a world that has state capitalism actors around, those are the mainland Chinese especially, we really need to think through whether what we're doing here is going to work, particularly if we retreat from science funding. So that's a long answer that's meandering around and basically not really able to prognosticate what's going to happen in the new Congress. But here's hoping that it settles out with a commitment to science. But I share the concern of many that there's going to be a rough ride between now and then.
Mr. Mollahan, if Tuesday's vote was a message to Congress to reduce the deficit by shrinking the federal budget, do you think that research should be protected from those cuts? And do you think that the new Congress will be able to do that?
Well, of course, I can't really predict, except we'll know that these accounts are going to be under pressure. Looking back, since the Rising Above the Gathering Storm report was issued, we have certainly leaned forward and tried very hard to support a doubling of NSF funding over that 10-year period. That represents a 7-year growth, and I think we really caught that up with the stimulus funding, which we had $3 billion for NSF, and roughly $2 billion of it was for grants. Looking at our bill today, you could look at it and say $33 billion of it is for NIST, NOAA, NSF, and NASA, which is obviously science funding. We would hope that that would be supported going forward. Obviously, you have to have concerns because of the kind of pressures that the political debate will bring on the budget are real, and those monies have to come from somewhere, and there's a lot of competition within those accounts. Equally of concern is that the projected requests for science in the president's budget, when you look at the year 2011, it's about $1 billion down for 12 when you look forward. So even coming from the administration, I think we have to be concerned about the commitment to science funding. So it is, I think, very important for this community to highlight it, and I think this is a very useful exercise in doing that, and I commend Science Magazine. But leaning forward and supporting funding for science on a bipartisan basis is extremely important, and the folks that you have on this conference call and that you want to have on this conference call, I think on a bipartisan basis, have supported science, and they are all good advocates for increased funding.
Mm-hmm. Now, the 10-year doubling that you referred to, or 7 years for NSF, DOE Science, and NIST is
7%
something...
7% a year.
Right.
About 7% a year over 10 years.
7%, right. That, as you said, comes from rags, is in competes. What would a spending freeze at 2008 levels mean for that? Would that just delay their growth, or do you think it's a whole new ball game? And Sherry, if you want to start with that, and then I hope the others will chime in.
First of all, let me say that Gathering Storm was very relevant when it was issued in 2005. It is even more relevant today, calling for the need for substantially more federal investment in R&D, calling for substantial more federal investment in STEM education. I think we have to look to the next Congress and take a realistic check of where we are, a reality check. And I think one of the important things for science to do is to change the vocabulary. No longer should we be talking about investing in science or just increasing R&D funding or STEM education because it's important for science. We should make this a national security issue, because a lot of the conversation is about the next Congress cutting all or freezing all non-national security spending. Well, I think we ought to take this funding and put it in the national security under that umbrella, because it is national security. Lessening dependence on foreign source oil, competitiveness, opportunity for our young people, the creation of jobs here at home. So I think we've got to change the vocabulary. And I would remind everyone that when Rising Above the Gathering Storm came out, then a case was made. I then was privileged to be chair of the Science Committee to OMB that you've got to heed it, read it and heed it. And then in 2006 State of the Union message, to his credit, President George W. Bush outlined the American Competitiveness Initiative, which was the forerunner to the America Competes Act. And what did Congress do? On a bipartisan basis, both the House and Senate responded by putting more money in for R&D, more money in for STEM education. But what happened? We didn't have appropriations bills that year because it was an election year. And so we ended up with a CR, so didn't get the increased funding. And then the new Congress came and America Compete was introduced. And to the credit of Bart Gordon and people like Alan Mollahan, that was advanced. But this is serious business, and we had better darn well recognize it. And I'm disturbed by some of the campaign rhetoric that thinks that all government spending is bad. Let me tell you, we have to have government spending, particularly in the area of investment and R&D, not just to advance science, although that's very important, but to enhance our global competitive position. We're being challenged as never before. Provide more opportunity for our young people, but that opportunity is not going to be there if they're not well educated in the science and math disciplines. I could go on, but I'm a creature of the House. Five-minute limitation.
All right. Well, since you mentioned government spending, I wanted to ask everyone about the stimulus package, because scientists of all fields, I think, believe the stimulus package provided an extremely important shot in the arm for research. But the public seems to feel it was a wasteful spending that didn't create good jobs and didn't improve the economy. What does it mean?
Well, the public gets most of its information from opinion merchants to on television, Fox TV and the like. The fact of the matter is we would be in real serious problem if we didn't have that stimulus package.
But what does it mean that that became such a partisan issue?
Well, this is Congressman Mollahan, if I might.
Sure.
Speak to that. In the stimulus package, we provided a big boost in NSF funding, roughly $2 billion in grants, $3 billion increase overall. And that really put us back on that doubling track. The stimulus package as a package was a real part of the political debate in the last year or 2 years. And I suppose that the funding in NSF is targeted along with the rest of it. I agree with Sherry that there has to be a national consensus that increase for research and development and science is akin to supporting economic growth and development of the United States of America generally. That's a mission that Science Magazine and the credible folks that create that opinion and market it successfully are very important, because in the political process, science funding is going to be competing against grants for policemen on the street. And sometimes that in that competition, science funding has to give, and that's unfortunate. If we went in, let me just suggest that we ought to be working against the CR, continuing resolution, this year, because a continuing resolution this year would cost science funding in our bill, our Commerce, Justice, Science bill, about $500 million just doing a CR. It would mean cuts, because we have increases in this bill over last year that would not be implemented if we went with a CR instead of passing a bill this year.
Mm-hmm. Mr.
No, if this is Brian Baird, if
go
I
ahead.
Could expand on what Alan's saying, I hope the scientific community appreciates the kind of contributions of people like Sherry Bollert and his Rising Above the Gathering Storm initiative, and Alan for his steadfast work on science as an appropriations chair. They're both gone now. And that's telling. You're not only in tight budget constraints, you're losing some real champions. Bart Gordon, the chair of the Science Committee, is retiring, as am I. Bob Inglis, Bernd Ehlers is leaving. So just the science community needs to know that some of their best champions are leaving right now, and that's going to create a vacuum. The other thing to look ahead to, I think, is there's much talk about we're going to eliminate earmarks, but my hunch would be that the practice of negative earmarking will continue and expand, and that science, particularly in the social sciences and other realms, may suffer from this. People will grandstand and take positions about how they're saving the public money by targeting particular areas of investigation and negative earmarking that. In other words, not just lowering overall budget total, but going actually into the weeds of the details of NSF grant approvals and saying, no, we're going to take money from this NSF-approved grant or NIH, and we're going to apply it instead, as Alan said, to something like police or mom and apple pie issues. And science needs to be mindful and watchful for that, because suddenly I think members of Congress are going to try to earn, especially the newer ones, try to earn some cheap political stripes by substituting themselves for the peer review process.
Now, do you think that scientists should have done more to rally support for stimulus, for the ideas in the COMPETES bill? I mean, are they out of touch with the public mood, why are they such an easy target for that kind of negative earmarking?
This is Brian Baird again. I don't think in the 12 years of service in the 300 town halls that I held, probably around 320 or so by the end of it, I don't think I ever once had a scientist at a town hall show up and say, "Let me tell you, Congressman, I appreciate your support for science." Nor do I think I ever recall having seen a scientist on a street corner waving a yard sign for me, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe a few of them were kind enough to contribute to my campaign, but scientists somehow feel themselves apart from or superior to the political fray and think that's not very wise. They need to think not only about how they can help people who fight for them, but also the realities of their own research. And the last thing I'll say on this is in regard to this negative earmarking issue, there will be much more pressure to see scientists moving in the applied or translational field, and basic research, though absolutely essential, may come under, to some degree, legitimate but also illegitimate attack by people who are saying, what's the bottom line? What do the taxpayers get at the end of the day for their money?
And they want it retroactively. Sherry Buller here. I can give the same examples that Brian has, all these town hall meetings. I never had anyone come and talk to me about the need for doubling the budget of NSF or for putting more money into STEM education or for basic R&D. Or people didn't even know that the DOE had an Office of Science yet. Our energy problems are one of our biggest challenges. So the science community has to be more engaged. And I think there's been significant improvement over the years, my experience. But they've got to come into the Congress, and not just as scientists talking about the importance of advancing science, but come in with the businessman or the university president and what this means to the university and Congressman so-and-so's district, and what this means to this business and Congressman so-and-so's district. And so deal with the very practical matters of how important this is all the way around.
Now, if scientists don't know how to do that after all the years of being told by people like yourself and others, how can they learn? Do you have any advice for them?
I don't want to be misquoted. That has improved substantially. When I first came in 82, I thought scientists were lousy advocates. They came in and talked to me. It was way above my head. The last science course I took was high school chemistry. I got a C. What do I know about all these various theories? I want them to talk to me about the importance of their work and what it means to the vitality of our economy and job opportunities for our young people and cures for diseases and solutions to problems in manufacturing. So they've got to be much more practical. But I think there's been significant improvement in the science community. There's still more room for improvement.
Mr. Inglis, do you think that your constituents in South Carolina are receptive to that message? Are they hearing about that, and does it have any impact?
Hearing about scientists actually engaging in public debate, you mean?
And as Sherry said, how the science is going to affect and improve the economy, how it's going to improve health care, how it's going to, you know, improve standard of living.
Well, I'd echo what Brian Baird was saying and what Sherry was just saying. It's very important for scientists to make it as practical as possible and to explain to us the implications of their research, because by doing that, they make it more real to people who are paying the bills. So we've got to explain to folks that are paying the bills, the taxpayers, why we're doing this research. And I think Brian Baird is exactly right. There are going to be some negative earmarks, people out there going after specific examples of scientific inquiry, which, you know, when you put them up on a PowerPoint and put them in a bad light, they do look sort of funny. You know, something about a snail and it's something, excrement from a snail or something. You're thinking, well, who would be interested in that? And surely you can cut out that. We can save money there. Well, then you come to find out that actually it has tremendous ramifications. The discoveries that you can make from that inquiry might be very far-reaching. And so by selling the sizzle of that, the scientist can help rescue us from a retreat from science and actually help lead an advance on science. But it is going to be a difficult time, I think. I think scientists are going to need to show up at town hall meetings and need to be out there with some yard signs especially through the universities. I think that's a powerful way to do it, because here in South Carolina, we've got, for example, the International Center of Automotive Research at Clemson University. This is a way of commercializing technology, and very exciting that here recently we had an announcement of 1,300 jobs with an electric bus manufacturer, Proterra. That kind of thing makes it real. So when you say, okay, we're spending this money at Clemson University's International Center of Automotive Research, this is what it's getting us. It just got us 1,300 jobs. And so the money that was given to Clemson, or they won in various kinds of grant awards, it makes it real. And then we've got these really fabulous scientists who can explain it. You know, what we need is to put forth the master teachers. Sherry led a trip to Antarctica, and Brian Baird led a trip to Antarctica. In both cases, we encountered some of the best of NSF's grantees. And if you have those people on the road and making presentations, then perhaps those master teachers can help those of us that, like Sherry and me, didn't get very far in high school science.
One of the areas that's very practical that I wanted to talk about is energy. Do you think, any and all of you, is there any type of clean energy or climate legislation that the House might be willing to pass in the next Congress? And if so, what would it look like?
Jeff, this is Al Monahan. Before you ask that question,
sure.
Could I just amplify a little bit on those themes about the scientific community and the community that's interested and appreciates the importance of increased funding for research as it relates to our economic well-being?
Sure, go ahead.
This is not a case where the scientific community doesn't have sympathetic ear in the Congress or the administration. It's more a case of supporting your friends in the Congress and the administration. Let me give you an example. Setting aside for a moment the constellation debate in NASA, it's very fair to say that the administration in the NASA request have favored science and technology. And they've done it in each year. They're doing it in 11. And if you look out through 2015, their projections are friendly to science and technology. If you look at their projected funding in NSF for grants, it's not so terrific. They don't really sustain the stimulus funding levels in their 12 budget. As a matter of fact, it looks like a decrease of about $1 billion to sustain that grant level in the out years. So on the one hand, they look favorable in their NASA funding, and not that they look unfavorable, but it's not as generous in their NSF grant funding. Well, we want them to be, I can tell you everybody in this conversation in the Congress would want them to be as sympathetic to the grant research funding in NSF as they are to their projected funding for science and technology in NASA. So the scientific community, I think, needs to help their friends help them. And you do that by focusing in on it and in some way popularizing these issues with the public and making the public understand in their lives why it's important. And, of course, that's why you play the economic card. But I just wanted to emphasize that there are friends here, and even the administration is your friends, although it's not reflected in every one of their budget requests. But you can certainly help that by highlighting it, thanking them, and then popularizing the importance of these programs to society generally.
Okay, yeah, that's an important message. And I think it relates actually to the next question about clean energy, because anything that's before Congress is certainly going to have to get widespread public support. Again, do you think there's any type of clean energy or climate legislation that the House might be willing to pass? And if so, what would it look like? Mr. Baird or anyone?
This is Brian Baird. I am 100% certain there will be no cap and trade bill out of the next Congress. If there is climate-related legislation proposed from the House, it is most likely to come in the opposite direction of that which is needed. 20 of the Republican Senate candidates expressed themselves proudly as climate skeptics. They're not actually skeptics. They're actually disbelievers. Skepticism might give them an actually open mind, which they don't have. But that's indicative of the problem. Bob, who can speak with much more personal pain and eloquence than I on this, but we have an anti-science attitude among many new members of Congress. Now, on the issue of energy and climate change, the only way to make a positive dent is not to pursue the failed and now dead cap-and-trade approach. The only way is to actually try to say we're going to actually reduce carbon by technological advancements and possibly behavioral changes induced by economic realities and national security concerns might also help motivate that. But if we're going to come together on an energy issue, it's going to be, gee whiz, alternative investments. Some of those more likely avenues may involve nuclear power, perhaps small modular reactors, et cetera, which we've had legislation pass our science committee on. But if we're going to move forward with climate, it will not be any form of cap and trade. I doubt there's going to be any likely cost on carbon, though Bob and I think, and maybe Sherry and others, would favor a carbon tax of some sort, but doubt that's likely. And I think, frankly, and last, I think there will be a huge backlash if EPA seeks to aggressively regulate carbon, even though perhaps it's justified both legally in court decisions and from an environmental perspective. It might lead to a backlash that actually rolls back other pollutant regulations in a way, sort of an unintended consequence. I wish I could be more cheery, but that's my most realistic assessment of what's happened with this election result.
Mr. Inglis, Tea Party candidates, as you know, stress the need to shrink government, limit spending, loosen regulations on business. Can the rise in carbon emissions be stemmed within that kind of philosophy?
Well, it can if conservatives think straight and have a little bit of courage, but that's sort of hard to do. You know, the guy that will replace me is famously said of climate change, seeing as how it hasn't been proved to the satisfaction of the people that I would represent, the answer is no, it must not be real. There must not be human causation in climate change. So I think that's something about science by polling data rather than science by listening to the people that we've spent, what is it, about $340 million a year on the U.S. polar programs. You would think that we might want to listen to those folks who have actually done that research and have produced results. But here's a challenge. We got to figure out a way to get the triple play of this American century, which is improving the national security of the United States, creating jobs, and cleaning up the air. I think that there's a way to do it. Not sure it'll happen in this Congress, but I have hope that perhaps halfway through the next Congress, we may be in a position of having convinced enough people by getting the scientists out to see these new members of Congress and acquainting them with the facts, acquainting them with the data, that then perhaps we could convince conservatives that the way to do this is to have the free enterprise system solve the problem. And the way you do that is by getting the negative externalities that are currently unrecognized in petroleum and coal, get those recognized, attach them to the product. And if you do, then all kinds of new technologies become possible. And of course, what I'm talking about here is a revenue-neutral carbon tax, which basically involves reducing taxes somewhere else. That's a conservative concept of no additional take to the government, actually reducing taxes elsewhere, so payroll taxes, for example, or other income taxes, and then in equal amount shift that to a tax on carbon dioxide. If you do that, then suddenly petroleum has new competitors and coal has new competitors. By the way, coal can also be used as an IGCC machine, which we've discussed quite a bit at Science Committee. Those are available to us. Technology's there. It's just there's no market for them because who would spend the extra money on an IGCC machine where you can belch and burn for free without accountability? So I have hope that at some point conservatives are going to come to understand that we really are into accountability, we are into free enterprise, and we are into conservation. And at that point, you come to the conclusion, okay, then how do you get the free enterprise system to fix it? I think there is a way. And the beauty of it, too, is I think that this could have support on both the left and the right. Everybody from Al Gore to Art Laffer could agree on this if they were thinking with an open mind. And I agree with Brian Baird that that's going to be difficult for a while because people have locked themselves into some positions. But if we could have some honest, open discussion, I think we could get to an American solution.
Mr. Mollahan, will West Virginians ever come around to that kind of approach?
Oh, my goodness. There are so many issues involved with that proposal. I mean, cost shifting, who pays that cost relative? That sounds like a shift to consumers. You know, the country is great for a lot of reasons, not the least of which, and maybe one of the most of which, is because it's always enjoyed reasonably priced or even cheap energy. throughout its history. And of course, coal represents the cheapest bulk energy produced in the country. I think that's a reality that the country has to start with, along with the reality that we have a problem and it's exacerbated. Global warming is exacerbated by human activity, and the large part of the problem is the tipping is human activity. So I think that does need to be recognized, and I certainly do recognize it. I agree with Byron that cap and trade is dead for a lot of reasons in our country. One of the reasons is concerned about the economic impact and who bears that cost. Coal has absorbed more regulatory activity since the 60s. The coal industry and the utility industry, more regulatory activity, statutory and otherwise, of any industry I know. And it has absorbed that successfully. In the environmental area, you know, SOx and NOx and ambient air quality has all cost the industry, regulating has all cost the industry a lot of money, but it's always been able to absorb it. And I think it can absorb the cost of reducing CO2 emissions. But perhaps a way to do that is for a lot of the research and development effort, certainly supported by federal funding for technologies that can deal principally sequestration, that can realistically in the real world deal with CO2 emissions, and maybe sequestration is the way to go. But the cost of doing that, I think, is going to have to be considered in the research area and at least a part of it, a significant part of it, borne by government. And then I think as part of that, trying to solve the carbon CO2 emission problem through government participation, the other thing is to be welcoming to all sources, including nuclear, of energy production, and have a multifaceted approach to continuing to supply reasonably priced energy to this country and achieving energy independence in the meantime.
Mm-hmm. Jerry, do you see any role for moderate Republicans? Do you think that they can help make the kind of case that Mr. Inglis was arguing?
Well, back in 06, when I announced my decision not to run again, the article in the next day's New York Times referred to me as an endangered species because of my moderation. Now it appears that I'm almost extinct. There has to be a role for the center in the American political scene. The Blue Dog Democrats have suffered just as much in the last election as in previous elections moderate Republicans suffered. Let's hope that after all is said and done and we go into the new Congress, people will come to their senses. Hope springs eternal. I'm not overly optimistic, but I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
All right. This next question is for anyone. Do you think that the promised investigations by House Republicans into federally funded climate science will lead to cuts in federal spending and climate research, including funding for NASA's Earth Science programs as well as the DOE?
That's all nutty, the federal investigations into climate science. That presupposes that you got a bunch of very distinguished scientists who are not only distinguished in their own university setting or their own state, but internationally are being investigated. I mean, the witch hunt the Attorney General for the state of Virginia is on with Michael Mann, for example, is a classic example. I mean, this is nutty. Why don't we agree that the overwhelming scientific consensus, overwhelming in the high 90 percentile of climate scientists internationally, say it's climate change is for real, man has contributed significantly to it, and then get on with how we deal with that reality instead of spending all the time demagoguing on the right and trying to demonize those people who tell us what their science leads them to conclude.
This is Brian Baird again. One of the things we're going to try to do in our remaining week in the Science Committee, we're going to have a multi-hour hearing where we're going to start with the very basics of physics and chemistry. Why do we think the ocean is acidifying? Why do we think the climate will change? Because I don't think we've made the basic case for the physics or the chemistry of those two phenomena. Then we're going to talk about, so if the basic physics and chemistry say it should happen, is there evidence that it is happening? Yes, there is, clearly. The temperature record plus the ocean acidification data, top scientists on each of those. Then what are the impacts of that? Then what are the consequences? And we're going to try to build the case in a much better way than it has been done. Now, I agree with Sherry. This whole business of McCarthy-esque oversight, supposed oversight hearings, but not oversight in an objective manner of is the taxpayer money being well spent and are we getting real data? Oversight with an explicit and intentional intimidation function that will obfuscate rather than clarify, and that frankly is designed to a large degree to tie up legitimate research so the people are A, intimidated and don't want to go into the field, or B, if they're doing it, they feel that they're under the gun and so much of their time is spent preparing for testimony on the defense that they can't actually conduct research. Frankly, I think that'll backfire. I don't think the American people in this last election, for whatever anger they did, said, what I really want Congress to do is conduct investigations that intimidate legitimate scientists. I think they'd be much smarter to spend their time on energy innovation and constructive solutions to the problem rather than denying the problem exists or conducting witch hunt type investigations.
Well, this is Al Mullahan, and I want to chime in and agree with both of those comments. These folks are engaged in a kind of a false denial, even a cynical fake denial for purely political purposes, and it's not only anti-science and anti-fact-based policy making, but it's just political demagoguery, and in large part, I think it is. I can't believe these people who are arguably bright, smart people actually believe what they are proposing. It's a denial, but it has to be just purely politically motivated. And I think to the extent it's exposed for that, we advance the argument here and get beyond that and get to real solutions. And I commend Brian for this effort and the remainder of this Congress.
But why is it effective politically, do you think? Mr. Inglis, even if it's just for political reasons, it seems to be working.
The very difficult thing is that we're here asking current taxpayers or consumers to shoulder costs for future generations. And it's just an inherent challenge. You got to convince people of the need and of their responsibility to their children and grandchildren. But I am encouraged by some people's approach. For example, Kim Beazley, who's the Australian ambassador to the United States, told me recently that whenever he encountered a climate denier in debate, what he would say to them is, make sure to get that on the public record. We want to make sure that you have fully expressed your denial and your disagreement with science on the record, because, as he says, I want my grandchildren and your grandchildren to know who is saying what. So very important that we get people on the record. Mm-hmm. And I'd take a slightly different take on this, and that's this. I would encourage the scientists to come to these hearings happily, with great glee, to mm-hmm. show the data that they have discovered, and to present it in a winsome way, not a defensive way, but in a way that takes the questions but then presents information. So I think that it's crucial that we have scientists who are master teachers who are going to do this testifying, to the extent that there's any choice in the matter and the ability to select who testifies. The best people to testify are those master teachers who have such command of the subject that they can speak to any level. They can speak to the PhD student, and they can speak to somebody like me, who's not a scientist on science committee. And so if they come to those hearings with an attitude of defensiveness, then it will drive the impression of the talk radio or 24-hour news cycle folks who say this is a bunch of hooey, and we don't need to spend any money on it, if they look defensive. But if they look welcoming of the inquiry and say, absolutely, we're happy you ask, because now we're going to be able to tell you what the data is and explain it in a way, and that's why I think what Brian Barrett is talking about here with these hearings is so useful. And I've had an opportunity to work with a supposed expert that's been put forth on many occasions by conservative groups who I think really don't realize who they're dealing with, a guy who claims to be a Nobel laureate who is in fact not. And so when you have that as the opposition, and let's hope they choose, somebody chooses to put that fellow on a panel, because then you'll have somebody sitting next to him who might in fact be a Nobel laureate. And the difference will become obvious. If we can just have capable witnesses, and especially master teachers who are able to explain it at any level, and especially put the hay down where the cows can get it, basically, to get it so I can understand what it is that they're talking about, which is back to what Sherry Bullard was saying about science being presented in a way that people can actually grasp it.
I wanted to talk a little bit about education and science and math education in particular. Someone had mentioned that, you know, leading advocates like Vern Ehlers, Bart Gordon, and Sherry Bullard yourself, you know, are no longer in Congress or won't be starting in January. Do you see anybody who's willing and able to take up that cause specifically for K through 12 science and math education? And in any event, what are the next steps that the next Congress needs to take?
Well, what you really need is to read Rising Above the Gathering Storm once again. And the reason that was so valuable, it wasn't those of us in Congress who believed that we're saying we need more investment in R&D and we need more investment in results in STEM education. It was the business community. So the business community is got to come out and be much more vocal, supported by the facts provided by the science community. I mean, everybody thinks that all these jobs are being outsourced because everybody is fleeing our country in search of cheaper labor. That is not always the case. In many instances, they're going elsewhere, the employers, because they don't have the talent they need right here. And why don't they have that talent we need right here? Because we're not growing enough of the talent. I mean, we're not doing enough to produce more engineers and more people in the science discipline, so we got to do a better job. I have to run. I'm sorry. I thank all my colleagues for they're more relevant because they're more current. I'm old hat.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Sherry.
And Sherry, thanks for all your work, my friend. You've done a great job for the country.
Thank you, guys.
Bye, Sherry.
Bye. Yeah, if the others, rest of you can stay for just a few more minutes. I realize I don't want to keep you too long. But let me just stay on that. Does STEM education need an advocate? Is it an issue that's difficult to actually get support translated into money and into new programs? And if so, who do you see on the horizon that could do that?
This is Brian Baird speaking. One of the areas where there might be some agreement would be the possibility, I think the Obama administration might share this perspective, the recognition that to attract skilled science and math and engineering teachers, especially into the high school levels and community college, there may need to be pay differentials. Now, that's going to be anathema to some of the teachers' unions, but it's probably reality, and it would certainly, I think, be appreciated by the Republican side because it's more of a free market kind of approach. I personally believe it's necessary to do it, but at the same time, there I think is going to be a serious and sustained assault on the Department of Education as an entity and on Department of Education funding. So federal level funding is going to take significant attacks, I think, in general across the board. That may filter over to the NSF's education operations as well. And I think Sherry was absolutely right. Business has been far too quiet about this. Now, what they tend to do has been they've given, you know, if you look at America Competes, endorsed by the Chamber of Commerce, National Association of Manufacturers, etc. But if you look at where their campaign contributions went, they don't quite literally do not put their money where their mouth is. They're happy to endorse legislation, but they don't fight vigorously to make sure candidates get in, nor do they make a public insistence that if a candidate is antithetical to investments in research and education, that candidate is antithetical to the interests of business and to the economic and security interests of this country. They just don't do it, and they need to.
Interesting point. Let me turn to higher education. Academic research enterprise in the U.S. is still considered the best in the world, but public research universities at a minimum are being hammered by declining state support, resistance to higher tuition, and rising costs. What do new universities need to do to survive and prosper, and what's the right role for Congress in that debate?
Bob, it's a hard question, and we have because in sitting with South Carolina's research institutions, for example, you look at how the state used to be their number one source of support. Now tuition is their number one source of support. So it means that families are shouldering much more the weight of this college education. The state share has dramatically declined. Of course, the research institutions have found some replacement with federal research dollars. That's helped. But it's what I would expect in the future is some consolidation among educational institutions because they're just expensive enterprises to maintain. And I would expect some consolidation as they're sort of forced to get together and figure out who takes up what disciplines and figures out what departments would have to go at some places but be present at others. It's a very painful process, though. And talk about politics. That's some serious politics at the university level on those kind of decisions.
There's a lot of talk of greater accountability. I wondered if Mr. Baird or Mr. Balahad could address what does that mean for research at a university? Does it need to be more accountable? And what would that word mean and how would it apply to federal support for academic science?
Well, if I could speak a little bit to that, I don't think that, at least on our committee, there is concern in the accountability area. But we want to lean forward with STEM education. We want to lean forward with increasing funding for research at our universities through the National Science Foundation. We are very pleased with the targeting coming out of our authorizers of doubling NSF in 10 years. That's something that we wanted to support and lean forward in supporting, and we're able to catch up in the stimulus funding. Looking forward, it's difficult to see how that is going to be sustained. If we're looking at budget numbers that are coming out right now from the administration and certainly that we can anticipate being supported by this new Congress. Again, we get back to almost the beginning of this conversation that the relationship between research and development in our great universities and the role the National Science Foundation particularly in funding and targeting that research for national purposes is something that needs to be supported at the popular level across the country. We need to sustain this funding level increase. Sitting here right now, looking at the president's projected budget for 12, we're not doing that, even in his budget. And we can anticipate the Congress, and when it gets down to the subcommittee level, not having the funding to support it adequately. I can tell you that Frank Wolf, who is my ranking member on Commerce, Justice, Science, and who has been chairman of this committee when I was ranking, is extremely supportive of science funding and STEM education and research funding by the National Science Foundation. He's a great fan of that, as I am. And we want to be supportive of the authorizers, and we want to be supportive of the community for increasing. But there has to be that consensus, and then there has to be money forthcoming in these budget resolutions.
Put this into context. It's absolutely important that every American, and especially people in academia, understand a fundamental fact. Every single penny of discretionary spending is borrowed money. The deficit exceeds all discretionary spending combined. Now, that's important for a couple of reasons. One, if we're going to get the deficit back under control, we've got to deal with entitlements, but we've also got to deal with discretionary spending. And if there are university presidents or department heads who are building programs as there have been some articles suggesting that there are many, many universities all building basically on spec, expecting that a portion of the budget's going to come from Uncle Sugar, and they're building these programs, building faculty, in some cases building physical infrastructure, and they're expecting that the operational costs are going to come from the feds, but they're all competing for a pie that's not big enough to be eaten by all. There are going to be some hard landings there, and people really need to factor that in. There would probably have to be hard landings anyway, but in this fiscal climate, it's going to be more so. So people need to be very, very careful about that. Secondly, that fiscal reality I just talked about, I think, puts an extraordinary onus on all of us as Americans, all of us, but that includes academic researchers, to consider the relevance and value of what we do. I've worked in the ivory tower, and I know that far too many of my colleagues have never really asked the question, is this worth the taxpayers' money? Now, I'm a passionate advocate for research, but if I've got to go back home and explain to a logger or a fisherman, a steel worker, a nurse, a department store clerk, this is why your taxpayer dollar is going to this research, I need an answer for those folks, especially given that we've got such high unemployment and such deficit. And I think the academic world needs to really think about what their answer would be. And it's got to be substantive and it's got to be valid. You have a moral responsibility to do that as an American, to be sure that what we do is worthwhile and relevant. And I don't think that's been stressed enough in our academic training or in our research communities. People run to the comfortable safety of, well, we never know what good basic research will be. It's always a mystery. Sometimes surprises happen. True enough, but that's not enough in this climate.
That's a good point. If I'd like to ask one last question, and I hope each one of you will tackle it. It has to do with the learning curve of new members of Congress. All of you, you know, came from different backgrounds, but have spent years or decades learning the issues, learning about research agencies, learning about how science is funded. How does a freshman educate him or herself about these issues? Where should they go if they want to understand science and innovation policy? Because surely they need to understand it before they vote on it.
Well, this is Al Mullen. A typical freshman of Congress who comes in here will, first month or so, work very hard to get on a committee that member thinks would be relevant to constituent interest or personal interest or personal expertise. And then they'll end up getting on a committee. And the committee and the senior members of the committee will be very active working the business of that community, and that member will be attending and getting up to speed on them and certainly have attitudes that represent the best interests of their constituency, whatever policy is before the committee. But in terms of being deeply educated into the science field, if they get on science and education committee, then they would be more likely to do that. If they get on a transportation committee, they'll be getting very up to speed on those issues. But the member will be preoccupied with getting reelected, is the reality of that, and won't have the kind of responsibilities, substantive responsibilities on the committee that would prompt them to get deeply involved even in the material in their committee until the second or third or fourth term or until they move up in seniority. If they're on a science committee, they'll begin learning soon. If they're on a non-science committee, unless they have a background in that area, they probably won't for a great deal of time become versed in the detail and the pros and cons of any particular issue on a matter, and they'll be voting their perceived constituent interest with regard to those issues and making every effort to get reelected with constituent service generally.
So is there any way for the community to provide help without running the risk of looking like they're asking for favors?
Well, this is Brian Baird. I think part of the answer lies in both what Sherry Bollard and Bob Inglis said earlier. You know, when Bob made the very important connection between jobs in his district and research and science development, Alan is exactly right. People are going to be focused on their election and on their particular committees of jurisdiction. You've got to, in some way, make it relevant. And it's not so easy for us politically to say, I voted on this legislation and it produced these jobs. I mean, obviously, if it's a transportation earmark or a defense industry, you know, this fighter jet or that aircraft carrier or something, that's tangible to people. It's more subtle, but no less important to make those links in terms of research and development. And that's important, and the scientific community needs to reach out in the business community. And it's easier in the areas where you've got the big federal research institution, whether it's a DOE lab or something of that sort, or where you've got a major research institution who will, you'll have a big population base right there in those districts. It's harder in the districts that don't have those immediate assets and resources. And that's where the scientists and businesses need to be more creative and more affirmative in their outreach to the folks who don't have the obvious linkages of either a big federal lab or research entity or a major university or business. They're going to have to be creative about that, but those people need that outreach as well.
Mr. Inglis, what about the learning curve for a new member?
Well, I think that there obviously is a significant learning curve. The advice that I would give to entering freshmen is to go see institutions in their districts that are relevant, because I think Alan Mullen is exactly right. It has to be relevant to the district. And so when they go see those institutions and hear what they're doing, that's a great way to introduce oneself to the science that's going on in one's district. Now, that also, the flip side of that is it creates a wonderful opportunity for your readers, because what many people assume is that members of Congress are unapproachable, that they are hard to get to, can't be reached. But I think everyone on this call will tell you that that's just not the case, that if somebody wants to see their member of Congress, they can see them. And if your readers have exciting things going on in their labs or research they want to talk about, they can reach that member of Congress, particularly if they have something to show and tell. That's always helpful. And to the very realistic point that Alan Mullen is making, if that's a media event, all the better for the scientist and for the new member of Congress. So if there's some exciting thing going on in a lab or some opportunity there, then the scientist should not feel that that is influence peddling. I think early in this call there's some reference to scientists hesitating because it might look like they're trying to get influence. Well, of course everyone's trying to get influence. That's what a constitutional republic is all about, is people trying to present their interest and to be heard. And scientists have an important message that needs to be heard. And sometimes it comes with visuals that are very interesting to the local TV station. They can highlight the work of the lab, and then that can also aid that member of Congress as they're looking relevant to the people in their district. But not everybody has what we have in the 4th District. We get a wonderful opportunity for that because Americans love their cars, and we have this Clemson University International Center of Automotive Research because BMW gave about $10 million of cash and $40 million of state incentives, and Michelin came along with a whole pile of money, too, to help. And so when you've got those things going on, you got a car to look at. That's an exciting thing. But there are other things. There are people with labs doing work on pharmaceuticals or various other biofuels, various things. Those things can be very exciting to people and can bring science into the classroom of public opinion and really help support what we were talking about earlier, which is adequate funding for science and for STEM education.
Well, I want to thank everyone.
One more point that I would like to make here, this is Al Mullen, if I might. You know, the AAAS has this Congressional Science Fellows Program, so you go a long way to introducing science to members, and certainly any member who is interested, I know, could contact you and express that interest, and that might be a program that you would want to promote and advertise to members, and you have science fellows. There are two members of my subcommittee who have science fellows, and one of the committee staff members was a science fellow of the Commerce Justice Committee, was a science fellow. So that's an excellent program, and certainly bring that expertise and presence into a member's office, which might be a very nice way to introduce new members to the importance of science as they look at policy issues up here.
All right. Well, thank you for making mention of that. It's an excellent program. And as you said, a lot of scientists have gone through it and have stayed in Washington to work on these issues. Well, again, I want to thank everyone. I appreciate the time that you took. Again, we've been talking with Alan Mullen, Brian Baird, Bob Inglis, and Sherry Bollert, all longtime members of the House who worked hard on science and research and education issues. And we'll be moving on to another stage of their careers. Again, thank you very much. I'm Jeff Mervis.
Great to be with you, Jeff.
Take care.